AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Monday. Good to be with you, Matt. Patrick here. Jack Rice is kind enough to join us, the best defense lawyer in town. You can go to find Jack Rice Defense at jackricelaw.com. That's jackricelaw.com. He is joining us today to talk about the beginnings of the latest trial involving the death of George Floyd. That is the federal trial of the other three officers. Jack, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Matt, it's great to be with you again.
Thank you. It's always great to be with you, my friend. Let's start talking about this. I mean, first of all, let's go back a few days to the beginning of this trial and the beginning of the jury selection and the trial against Lane, King, and Tao. These are the other three officers who are on the scene, two of which helped hold down George Floyd. The other one was standing there making comments while the other, Derek Chauvin murdered him and the other two officers helped. That's not me. You know, I don't think I'm kind of a bouncer. I've seen the videos. That's kind of what happened. This is a federal case. It's not the Hennepin County case, correct?
That's correct. In fact, that Hennepin County case has been continued. Originally, that was set to start in March, but it's been pushed back to June. So in other words, there's two different things going on right now. And the same thing happened with Chauvin, actually. There are the state cases, the state trial in Hennepin County, where Derek Chauvin was found guilty, and those three other officers are waiting for trials in June. Then there are federal charges where they essentially were all charged with constitutional rights violations against George Floyd. Now, we know that Derek Chauvin has already pled guilty in the federal case to run alongside the state case. The other three are being charged, and they're in the middle of a trial right now.
One of the things that was interesting is at the beginning of this trial, the judge came on out and said, this case is not about racism. And is it because they're dealing with the civil rights violation? Because I mean, is he trying to split a hair there, or I didn't quite understand where he was going with that. Is it a case where he's just trying to establish this is the law and this is how the law should be applied, versus is this some sort of Kyle Rittenhouse thing where the judge is kind of seeming to make rulings on the one side?
Well, I think that what Magnuson's really trying to do in this case is to say that race is not a required element here. Race is not a piece of this case in the sense that the evidence must show on its face that what these people did is they deprived George Floyd his constitutional rights. It's not a race question. It's not how they did it or even why they did it, but whether they did it. And I think that's what he's trying to establish. I also think that a big part of this is to try to sort of calm the situation. Let's face it, the entire world was looking at Minneapolis and St. Paul for a really long period of time. And I think what he's trying to do, what a lot of people have been talking about, is the idea of trying to calm people down to realize, let's let this process take its course.
The jury selection that did happen last week, it very different. Once again, it's not just drawing from Hennepin County, it's being drawn from the entire state, correct?
That's correct. I mean, federal trials are fundamentally different than state trials. I mean, you can look back at other trials in the past. They can take weeks and weeks for jury selection in state court. The difference between state court and federal court is pretty profound, at least when it comes to jury selection stuff. What happens is the judge controls a lot of it. So in other words, what you'll find is that there will be questionnaires that went out to all these potential jurors. But in the end, the judge really asks just about everything. And they really don't give the attorneys much wiggle room. And so as a result, there were only a few follow-ups in this case before they picked 12 juries plus six alternates.
The jury selection, and you and I have talked about this in past cases, in this case, it's predominantly white. I guess I don't understand to a point. I mean, I know, as you just described, there are the differences between a federal trial and a state trial. But at the same time, I mean, is the screening process the same? Is it similar, at least, where, you at least try to find people who are like, oh, yeah, I love the cops and I never find a cop guilty? Well, clearly that person should be removed from the jury.
Well, there's no question about it. And in fact, a lot of those very same questions would have been asked during that questionnaire. So that's a big piece of it. I mean, one of the things that I think is important to remember is this, is that is race an issue? Race is always an issue. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but it is, in the sense that people look at people and they have preconceived notions, whether they want to acknowledge it or not. And that is just simply the truth. Now, what rolls out of that is the idea that if I have preconceived notions, does that mean that I perceive people differently? Yes, we all do. At the same time, do I think that some people are more honest than others? That's really part of this question, right? But if we think about the jury pool itself, think of it like this. The jury pool in Minneapolis is the most diverse in the state of Minnesota. And St. Paul is pretty close thereafter as well. But you get into greater Minnesota, it changes dramatically. So in other words, what you could see is while Minneapolis is about 75% white, give or take 25% people of color, what you're going to find is you go to St. Cloud, you go to Duluth, you go to Bemidji, you go to Marshall, you go outside, all of a sudden you see dynamics like this. Hence what we have are the estimates I'm hearing right now of the 12 jurors plus the six alternates. The breakdown is essentially like this. We have about, 10 women. We have 8 men, and about 16 of the 18 appear to be white. That's about as good as we're getting right now in terms of the numbers, I mean.
You know, when I remember, was it the case of... was it Fernando Castillo, when they had his trial, they had one woman on the trial who owned a business that had a contract with the police. And it always blew my mind. It's like, how in the world does that person get on the jury? Do you think that, you know, I maybe that's the perspective I have here is I think I'm looking at this in the modern sense of jury selection in Minneapolis or in Hennepin County, I should say, that it just doesn't seem like, yeah, you clearly have, you can't anymore have ringers on the jury. We're not going to allow that. We have to have people that can evaluate a court, you know, a case, you know, straightforward. And we had that case. We had, of course, the case up in Brooklyn Center. You know, you have guilty charges now being placed on police officers, and they're going to jail. Muhammad Noor as well. But yeah, I mean, yeah, well, so I kind of, is that same standard, you know, is that the same standard, or do they still have some of that, a little bit of that old style of, well, you know, we'll try to trim this back as best as we can, but we can't really guarantee that we're going to be able to screen all of this out of the jurors?
Well, see, that's part of the problem, right? I mean, part of the problem is, and I picked a lot of juries in my career, everything from just simple assaults to murders. And the problem with these is that you don't always get the information that you want. Now, frequently, you may get very little to nothing from some people as to how they actually feel, what they actually believe. There will be some people out there who will simply say, yes, I can be fair, and there's your standard. The problem is frequently the jury that you get is the jury that you know the least about. So in other words, people who say terrible things, you're like, oh, my God, that person has to go. And yet, I recall a really serious case that I was dealing with where one of the potential jurors was actually the wife of a chief of police. And I had to fight to get that person off the jury, even though that person actually knew some of the other people who would potentially be witnesses. And part of that comes because what you find is that judges want to seat juries. They want cases to start. And so for them, their inclination is to get things moving. Well, sometimes my inclination is to figure out where I am so we can actually have a fair jury. I'm not saying the judge doesn't want that too, but they also are watching the clock.
Yeah.
So that's sort of part of the problem.
I think that's good. Between the two things, the statement about there's not race involved, and then they sat that jury real fast. And I'm like, okay, what's going on here? I appreciate you clarifying this for me, because I think I'm a little bit off the edge.
I have to tell you, yeah, I mean, that is part of the issue though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can even remember, think back to the Chauvin trial where you all of a sudden had one person who came out later that was actually at a function in Washington, D.C., involved in potentially the debate of George Floyd wearing a shirt that says, keep your knee off my neck or something along those lines.
Yeah.
You could make the argument, he's a ringer the other direction. But the problem is neither side, prosecution nor defense, ever knew about it until after it was over. So what do you do when you just don't know who the people are that are actually potentially your jurors? That's one of the difficulties of picking a jury, why it's so challenging.
The officers have an interest, you know, like I said, the video, we've seen the video. They've got a very interesting, you know, problem ahead of them because they have to basically say what you see with your own eyes is not really what happened. The defense has put forward their opening statements today. Thomas Plunkett, the attorney for King, described his client as a rookie officer failed by the Minneapolis Police Department's inadequate training. He said he only saw that was right in front of him rather than the wide view, the bystander video. That video is not what King saw, said Plunkett. I'm going to presume that's going to be something the other officers are going to try to argue too. Tao's lawyer called the death a tragedy, although a tragedy is not a crime. Now, Tao, it should be mentioned, was not an officer on top of George Floyd when he died. So it's going to be interesting to see his case. But trying these all three together, I mean, is that the best defense for them, is to take the myopic look, to say, well, from where I say, yeah, you guys got this video where you're standing 10 feet behind me. I'm just looking at the part of the body I was sitting on. I'm looking at the crowd. I wasn't paying attention to what was going on, to basically just boil it down to what was in front of their eyes and hope that that offsets the videos.
Well, I think you have to do that to some degree, because imagine if you have 14 different views of a scene, some of which are 25 feet up from a camera on the top of a building that's looking down on the scene, to lots and lots of other views from vest cams, from individuals, all those things. Just because somebody else sees something doesn't mean that the person themselves does. But I think an interesting aspect of this case, regardless of what people saw or didn't see, is that this is slightly different than a lot of people might consider, because the idea of depriving constitutional rights is kind of an inverse argument. Because if you think about it, what you're having to say is, it's not what they did, it's what they were supposed to do and didn't do. See what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's actually different than one might think. I mean, one of the examples, and this is one of the interesting ones, regarding our former officer Lane, the guy was on the force for 4 days, a grand total of 4 days. He's the same officer who actually said, shouldn't we roll him over twice? They have it on tape. And so we have him asking this question. You have a very senior officer who was the lead officer, Derek Chauvin, saying no to him. And then the second time that Lane asks, Derek Chauvin actually ignores him. And so the question becomes, what is a four-day on the force officer to do where an officer of 15-plus years, whatever the number is it tells you no very specifically and then ignores you thereafter? Because in many ways, a lot of police officers and police departments see themselves very military-like, and so the idea is it's hierarchical. We do what we're told. We are trained by the officers above us, and we do our best, but they're the ones who tell us what to do. But see, that's not what the law says. The law in this case is much different than that. What the law actually says is you have obligations. Officers must intervene when they see that excessive force has been used, or in this case, what they're also saying is when they see the need to get medical attention for somebody. That's, in fact, all three of those officers are charged with that. So in this case, it's one of those things where, and this is actually what the prosecutor said today, it doesn't matter that they were new officers. They still had obligations. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're going to get from some of the from some of their defense counsel is that realistic? Is that fair? Does that make any sense? And I think that's one of the questions you're going to put before a jury, and that's what they're going to have to answer.
And that's the interesting element, is like, you were trained, weren't you? You don't just become a welder. You have to go to welder school. You can't just be a
cop.
And it's interesting. There's that case. I don't know if you've seen the video of I think it was in Texas, where the guy was, getting out of line with the suspect. The female officer grabs the officer by the utility belt and does what she's supposed to do and pulls him back. And the other officer whips around and starts choking her. And it was all caught on tape. And now that guy is under investigation, obviously, as he should be. But it does present an interesting case where there she did. I mean, there literally was a case where she literally grabbed the cop and pulled him off and said, no, you can't do this. And the officer, you know, there were consequences for that when that officer tried to choke her. No one you don't see, if I'm the prosecutor, that's what I'm going to point to, is like at no point did anyone here try to pull Derek Chauvin off of George Floyd as they should have.
Well, how's this for a twist? If I'm not mistaken, that's a pretty old case where that officer is actually they're looking at now. That case goes back to about 2007. You know what happened to that officer who pulled him off? She was fired. So let's think about that for a second, right? I mean, this adds to the mix. I'm not saying good, bad, left, right, nothing. It's a question of when you think about the process and you think about the nature of police departments, the real question that's going to happen in this case, and I think this is actually the really big part of what this is about, if you think about what's really important is this idea of intervention, whether or not police should intervene and why they must intervene. But the second part is about the training of intervention. What kind of training, and this is exactly what Tom Plunkett for King said, was what kind of training are these officers receiving about not just use of force, but what happens when you have an officer or maybe even a senior officer telling you what to do and what you're supposed to do in response. So what we're trying to see now is, does this change the behavior of not just these officers, but Minneapolis police officers, frankly, police officers across the country?
By the way, just FYI, that case I was referring to, I just pulled it up. It's January 15th. It was in Sunrise, Florida, actually, not Texas. And the sergeant did that. So it's a current, that one is actually a current case.
That's a current one.
Well, how many, that's a sad world when we actually can, there are multiple officers choking other officers cases that we can refer to. That is the better strategy, though, as you just brought up, for these officers that are on trial. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the Minneapolis Police Department does not seem to have the best track record when it comes to training people. That Rolling Stone article is a great example. They could just throw the department under the bus, and I think that might actually be a decent defense.
By the way, the one I was talking about, there was a Buffalo officer. Her name was Carol Horn. She was fired after intervening in a 2006 case in which there was a chokehold in Sunrise, Florida.
Wow.
2006. That's the case you're talking about.
Oh, my God. That's.
Come on, brother.
Oh,
I got you.
It could be the same. It could be the same town, different cases. Because this one actually, this case is from January 13th. The video is from January 13th of this year.
Yeah. So it's a brutal question right now, and I think part of the problem is obviously there is a history in this country of police misconduct, and there is a history in this country of people looking the other way, being deferential to the police and simply saying, oh, it's a tough job, and that's the end of it. Of course, people then bury their parents, they bury their children, they bury their cousins, they bury their neighbors. And you say, well, you know, too bad, so sad. Well, guess what? That simply is unacceptable anymore. The question will be for this jury is that are they going to see this and say, too bad, so sad? Or are they going to look at it from the defense perspective of, these are brand new cops. How do you hold them at a level of responsibility that you hold the Derek Chauvins of the world? Are they different? The standards say there is no difference. The prosecution is saying there is no difference. The standard is the same whether you've been on the force for 20 years or for 2 days. And so will the jury agree?
You are much smarter than me. You got me on that one there.
Let's write this down.
We'll send you a copy. You can use this as your ringtone. Jack Rice is smarter than me. There you go. One final question for you on this one. Okay, so and just as a legal mind here, so here's the trouble these officers run into. With the federal case now going before the Hennepin County case, if they're found not guilty by the federal case, then there seems to be going to be probably a lot of pressure on the Hennepin County case to, you know, that's going to take that into account. Is anyone going to hold these officers accountable? If they're found guilty in the federal case, then the opposite might weigh true. I mean, am I right? I mean, is that there are going to be consequences for whatever the ruling in this case is that is going to have an impact on the Hennepin County case, correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Anything that happens first impacts what comes thereafter. Some could make the argument that those consequences for those officers have already come. meaning they've lost their jobs, meaning that they're running through two sets of trials, both federal and state trials, plus the insanity that comes with that, the financial responsibility that comes with that. But they've never really spent time in jail or in prison. At the same time, how about if you think of it like this? If you look at the federal case, because technically the law is so slippery on this issue, the standard is actually this. Because somebody died, because George Floyd was murdered, and if they can prove that this was part of that process, that technically, they could face the death penalty for this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. certainly up to life in prison. If we remember George Floyd's murderer, Derek Chauvin, ultimately will serve between 20 and 25 years, but that's really going to run concurrent to the 22 and a half years that he's serving in state court. And so as a result, it's basically a concurrent sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as I understand it, there was no offer made to any of these three defendants at this point. So in a way, I sort of understand the logic of saying, hey, if I open myself up and plead guilty to something without any end date, is that really a smart idea? So there it is.
Can you, I'll tell you what, I might have to call on you again over the next few days here. If we get some more developments in this case, if you're available, I'd love to have you back on, my friend.
Always. You know that.
The best defense attorney in Minneapolis, St. Paul is Jack Rice. JackRiceLaw.com. That's JackRiceLaw.com. That's where you'll find Jack Rice Defense. Give him a call. Sit down. Discuss your case with him. He'll give you the straightforward truth. You want to have a defense attorney you can trust. You can trust Jack Rice. I trust him emphatically. Jack Rice, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today, my friend.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Take care. Jack Rice. We'll spotlight Jack every time. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.